soon, till my horse tired through darts and balloons, till I won. And I drank all the lemonade, drove bumper cars, till it seemed like I owned the whole bar. And wherever I went, well, I shook every hand. I said, welcome to my wonderland. I said, welcome to our wonderland.
The rule book and calendar of Kittery Embers. Chapter 10, Tamerlane. The air was crooked in the minister's mouth, as though he'd forgotten how to breathe. His eyes snapped open. Shadows rummaged on the green, flickering wall. The foul smell of dirty blood was gone. He rubbed a hand across the front of his neck. There was a curious lack of pain. His last memory was of surprising agonies throughout his body. Choking himself had unleashed all manner of unexpected misery. Hot wires bristling his bones, tiny razors cutting his skin. No one warned you about such things, of course. But now, after he'd done himself in and been revived by his own black fire, he felt soaringly free of all discomfort, better than he had in years, a little numb, even, as though encased in a protective layer of ice. Spring chicken, he murmured to himself with pleasure. He extended his arms and flexed his fingers and then played his hands together happily until he saw that he was clapping, a kind of applause for himself in the dim, cobbled hall. I did it, he said, with emphasis on the I and some confusion as to what it exactly was. He clapped harder for himself. More information on black fires would be gotten from Mrs. Brushes later. Certainly, he was no longer dying from the monarch's murder fingers. Had he somehow, was it even possible, just now, defeated death? Had he, unwittingly, pushed himself into the territory of the everlasting? Unkillable, he wondered, very much liking the iron quality of such a state. He stood alone in the gloomy light. Most of the blood pool had seeped into the floor, but a murky puddle still draped over a small body in the middle of the cupped room. The two rule books were no longer on the table. Mrs. Brushes and the monarch must have taken them. He stepped forward in the shallow ichor, as Mrs. Brushes had called it, and peered down at the tiny figure on the floor. The monarch's bony frame was almost unrecognizable but for the ragged skirt. When he'd seen Kittery Embers standing over him, he'd known instantly that it was not his granddaughter. It was her body, yes, but the frosty look in her eyes had given it away. Whatever Mrs. Brushes had done when she'd gone tearing around in the blood had somehow given the monarch control over the girl's body. But what a lightness of weight all through him! His old rusted knees were as soft and oiled as the greased-necked gudgeon of the counting-house belfry. The knotted muscles in his shoulders were untied and savvy. If he knew a single jig, he would have performed it now. He made do with a number of freewheeling punches and kicks.
Minister, don't make me come down there.
The harsh voice of Mrs. Brushes shot down the hall. He adjusted his hat, pleased that he'd retained his rank beyond death, if that's where he was, and strolled, rather slowly, up the sticky cobbles. Mrs. Brushes stood waiting, back turned toward him, elbow jutting to one side, as though petulantly anticipating his services as an escort. He wouldn't take her arm, and he would walk at his own pace. From the very start of this afterlife, or whatever it was. He would let Mrs. Brushes know exactly where each of them stood. He was about to say, as humbly as he might, "I did it," in the hope that Mrs. Brushes might volunteer some mild summary of what he could expect now. Eternal life, unkillableness, endless pleasures, perhaps a new hat, a crown, he wondered. But his jaw dropped open on the glittering scene. The brimstone cavern of shifting walls and licking fires had been entirely transformed. A white marble floor blazed beneath countless spectral windows, through which a moon-silver light diffused. Enormous rugs of every variety, thick vast ovals, and smooth bright strolling carpets, unfurled in every direction, leading to various cozy nooks and gentlemen's smoking areas. Against the far wall, the minister saw the longest buffet he'd ever seen. Silver-edged chairs surrounded a dark-milled dining table, which was heaped in a steaming treasure of food. "Expecting company," he said in a cool tone, as though none of this surprised him. Mrs. Brushes set off briskly along the emerald strolling carpet, and the minister followed, a little too quickly for his taste. "You and the monarch will go into town," Mrs. Brushes said, "you brandishing her, she brandishing the rule book. And won't the salty old birds be happy as fish rags to see their princess? All of the villagers are to be invited back to the palace for a feast, and then, of course, the coronation." "I see," the minister said, which was what he always said when he didn't. Mrs. Brushes took his arm and pushed him off the rug. "Of course you don't see, minister. You haven't even the faintest idea, but leave you that to me. Only thing you need do is watch that mouth. The monarch herself will tell them what they want to hear, and you just nod and tap your toes and now and then say how pleased you are that Kittery Embers has finally defeated the monarch." "That Kittery Embers," he said uncertainly. To maintain a dignified preserve in the swelling symphony of his confusion, the minister began to stare at an enormous silver raft of crackers on a nearby side table, as though snacks were on a higher level of interest than anything Mrs. Brushes could say. "Hungry?" the old woman asked slowly. Her lips cradled a small smile. "Try a cracker, Minister Battlegrass." Now that she'd said it, he found his belly aching with need. It didn't help that he continued to feel the air drawing badly into his mouth, as though there were a shut door in his throat. It made him lightly mad with the urge to consume something, to get something inside. He snatched a cracker from the silver service and popped it whole into his mouth. Mrs. Brushes giggled and watched him closely. At first he was troubled by the lack of any discernible taste. A moment later, he spit the chewed fragments back into his palm. Not only had the cracker lacked flavor, it had filled his mouth with sharp bits, as though he'd been chewing glass. "What the devil? Trick crackers, Mrs. Brushes," he said with contempt. "Just crackers, Minister. Can't haul everything out of a black fire, can we?" Mrs. Brushes observed. "The old pleasures are gone. Eating, drinking, breathing." Then she appraised him coldly. "But you'll find new ones soon enough. New ones soon enough. Oh dear, yes." "Well, they told me I was blind, and they dragged me out to sea. I reckoned if I sank now, well, at least I would be free." "I've been playing out the line, made the fish hook a time. Cast again, hope all my sins can be forgiven now." "
reckoned if I sank now, well, at least I would be free.
He stepped slowly through the strange misty forest of cool moss and shattered stumps. Brown clouds tumbled gently in the antique blue of the sky above them. The old woodpecker that was Archie sat on her shoulder. The old mouse that was Mrs. Gramshaw dangled amiably from his talons. The old worm that was Mr. McIntosh hung like a horseshoe around Mrs. Gramshaw's neck. Almost the moment they'd arrived, a tedious discussion had ensued about their actual whereabouts. "Definitely feels like Fourth Forest," Muck said. "At the edge of Olive," he added kindly, for Kittery's sake. "Not at all," Mrs. Gramshaw replied. "It's the unfound wild, and no question." "Based on what, Keepsy? Have we found it, then?" "You're guessing same as I," Muck answered. "Many people have been to the unfound wild, Muck. You know that," Mrs. Gramshaw continued. "They just can never find their way back again. Besides, I've never seen a wood like this, with moss everywhere, and the ripped-up trees and the fog. And look at that sky. That's not an olive sky." "Often a great old fog blundering round in Fourth Forest," Muck said, "and moss as far as the feet can walk." Mrs. Gramshaw battered the worm with a paw. On and on it went. Kittery stopped listening and began to concentrate on the forest itself. Some of the stumps were shattered at the level of the moss, but others extended up almost to their full heights before revealing their jagged, shredded tops. She inhaled the snow-like vapor of the fog, which seeped up from the moss like the cool breath of the earth. They wandered aimlessly for a while, Mrs. Gramshaw and Muck both shoring up their arguments with different theories about splintered trees and misty moss and the varieties of sky that could be found in Olive. Archie had no opinion at all on this. The only thing he added, with a strong beat of his wings, was that their search should be done from the air. But Kittery had resisted this. She quoted one of her rules: "When there's nothing you know, move as nothingly slow." Every time Archie brought it up, she said simply now, "Rule 11, Archie," and he'd shrug his wings. But it was the fog itself that finally struck Kittery. The way it maintained its receding rainbow distance. She suddenly remembered chasing the fog as it skidded over the swamp, trying to follow it over the muddy field, trap it in her hands. She told them the rule as it popped into her mind. "There are two ways back, and one's the pool. But follow the fog and find the school." "What's that, dear?" Mrs. Gramshaw asked. "That's rule number 2, Kittery said. "I just remembered it. We need to follow the fog." The little mouse that was Mrs. Gramshaw swelled with success. "Tamerlane is what it means, then," Mrs. Gramshaw said. "So we are in Meadowlark, Muck." "Maybe, maybe not. Could be the old school in Fort Forest what it means," he said grumpily. "Oh, my letters. You infuriate me, Mr. McIntosh. The historian is a Tamerlane. I'm certain we are meant to talk with him." Mrs. Gramshaw was almost inaudibly angry. Kittery felt both Muck and Archie shudder at the mention of the historian. "Arch Leslie Mumford?" Kittery said the name doubtfully. It had suddenly appeared in the silver lining of her mind before anyone had spoken it. "Mumford is the only living historian left," Mrs. Gramshaw began. "Of the 3 original historians, he was considered, well, the other 2 called him the Mistorian," Muck said, and held back a laugh, "because all his predictions were misses. He went years and years like that, completely wrong. Didn't stop him from writing everything down, though, did it, Archie?" "His predictions?" Kittery asked. But the moment she asked it, the shared knowledge of her companions began to fill in her silver lining. Mrs. Gramshaw explained it anyway. "The history is not a book of the past. It is a book of the future, of what is to be. In some ways it may be considered a rough form of your rule book, and the monarch's rule book, or a mix of both, depending on which side is winning." Archie and Muck both sighed. dreary, unreliable bunk, Muck said. A 2-foot-tall stack of hard-to-read dreams, and half of it filled with the predictions of Arch Leslie Mumford. We had to read it at Tamerlane, Archie said. Both feet of it, especially his foot of it. Read that twice. His wings shuddered with the memory. Mrs. Gramshaw intervened pointedly. But Mumford has been fairly accurate, she said, at least recently. Once, Muck said sharply, and Kittery saw, in her silver lining, that it had been Arch Leslie Mumford who had sent Archie and Muck to fetch her from the swamp. But Kittery, we've been out loads of times, Archie said, when he saw Kittery warming to the man. Gone all round the world, Archie and I have, in that old black rattler, Muck added, in those great heavy suits. Kittery stared down at the moss below her feet. There was a bright knob of fog that seemed stuck on the tufted curls of the sponge below. I don't mind if he's wrong most of the time, Kittery said absently. He was right when I needed it. As she reached down to touch the quivering egg of fog, it suddenly darted off into the next tree. Kittery leapt after it. Each time she tried to grab it, the cottony egg flew upward and away and resettled on a further tree. The forest spread wider, and the mossy ground gave way to a fine, mortared sand, equally as cool and pleasant as the moss. The egg of fog had nowhere to roost now in this wide and empty plain, and instead began to skitter around at Kittery's feet, as though daring her to step on it. She could feel Muck peering through her eyes, and then Archie too. "What is it?" she whispered. Across the open plain there stood a warren of haystacks, like tiny cold teepees. "What do you think?" Muck whispered to Archie. "Could be the back end," Archie said. They moved slowly over the dust plain, with a little leg of mist leaping out before them. As they drew closer to their haystacks, the bit of playful fog grew larger and thicker and broader, until it had cast itself all around them like a net of smoke. Kittery's feet locked to the ground when she saw them. Dozens of shadowy faces peeking through the fog, small and dirty and sullen in the mist. "This is Tamerlane," Mrs. Gramshaw whispered, "and these are the children of Olive." Kittery stepped uncertainly through the haystacks. The silent children, like the fog, kept their distance. Some of them limped, some had great bloody scratches over their cheeks and across their bodies. Some were even crying. "What happened to them?" Kittery asked. "Just finished class," Archie said indifferently. "It's not always like this. It must be training day," Mrs. Gramshaw said.
"Just as I predicted, yes. Shh!"
A whistling voice hushed out from the fog. Kittery turned sharply. Seated at the bottom of an open haystack was a very small man bundled in layers of clothes. Smoke issued from his pockets and slipped out through the cuffs of his shirt. Around his chest, high, middle, and low, perhaps keeping the ensemble together, he wore 3 old belts, tightly strapped, their loose ends wagging like tails before him.
"Arch Leslie Mumford,"
he whistled, and once again shushed them.
"No words," he intoned. "I know exactly who you are," he said.
He stood slowly as smoke and excess clothing tumbled around him. After bowing, he suddenly blazed his eyes wide open.
"You're wondering about them, the children," Mumford said,
as though divining the fact.
"Not a single goody amongst them, I'm afraid. No help to you in your coming battle with the monarch. I've done my very best to tease out their talents, but sadly, Archie was my only real find in the last number of years, although he's not here at the moment."
Mumford cast about the dirty, injured children.
"Archie is here," Kittery said, and nodded to the old woodpecker on her shoulder.
"Shh!" Mumford shook his head. "I know that," he claimed quietly.
"So," he continued, "we've just finished a fresh round in the Vens. The children need mending and washing. I push them hard because they fail so readily and steadily, but not
merrily. But it can be difficult, so difficult, to find your special something. Kittery's face wrinkled in confusion. And now you're wondering about the Vens, Mumford said, smiling to himself. He evidently liked to divine imminent questions rather than have them asked. The Vens are the training ground for the nine powers. Sight, strength, flight, breath, speed. Oh, all of them, he faltered, and then brushed away the remaining powers in a way that suggested they could just as easily be guessed at. Ask him if he knows why we're here, Mrs. Gramshaw interjected. Do you know, Kittery began, but Mumford held up a hand and silenced her. Shh, of course, certainly, Mumford said, but we needn't go on and on. Tell him he must visit the ex-conjuratory at once, Mrs. Gramshaw said, growing impatient. The ex-conjuratory, Kittery said, simply, to prevent Mumford from hushing her. He glared at her icily and then softened. By all means, he said. But first, a proper welcome, a ceremony, of course, and then, oh yes, I will go to the ex-conjuratory and we will learn of our future. But first, Kittery, would you be kind enough to sit in the grainy riggings while the children clean and have their wounds tended? He directed her to the shadowy haystack he himself had been sitting in. And obviously, before anything, as the children are all here, before they get ready, I will ask you the ceremonial question. I have been waiting years for this moment. Mumford looked to the sky and shivered with the pangs of destiny. This ceremonial, Kittery began, shh, about your mighty power, so the children wear the right hats, etc. A single word is all I require. I'm sure you're fully aware of it by now. One of the nine great powers. My own, of course, is insight, of course. The spectacular ability to see that which cannot be seen, to know that which has not yet happened. Kittery went instantly to her silver lining. Mrs. Gramshaw, my special power, she said. Do I have a special power? For a short time, none of them responded, and Kittery wondered if they could talk amongst themselves without her hearing. Finally, Mrs. Gramshaw spoke. It would seem that you do not have a special power, Kittery. If you did, it should likely have made itself clear to you, even back in the swamp. Of course, we can't be certain unless you were tested in the Vens, but each of us, Archie, Mark, and myself, we knew long ago, and naturally, about our gifts. Mark didn't need the Vens to discover he was strong. Archie didn't need the Vens to know that he would one day fly. And I certainly always knew about my extremely excellent eyes. Kittery stepped toward Arch Leslie Mumford. No words, my dear, he breathed. All is well. Shh! I shall ask the question, and you may answer with a single word. One word is all it takes. Of course, I already know the answer, but the children will need to hear it so they know what hat. I want to be tested, Kittery said. Mumford's face thinned to a wire, and a long snake of smoke rose from his collar. Before he could say it, she held her finger to her own lips and said, "Shh! I need to be tested now in the Vens."
I am the ocean, I live where I drown. The moon turns me over, the sun burns me down. I am the mountain, I rise like a wing. The wind is my shepherd, the trees are my king. What can I do? What can I do?
Listen to the trees and the birds and the bees and the bark and shell and the church and bell. Blessed is the breeze on the whistling leaves and the wishing well.
I am the river and I am I am the silence and I am the sound. I am the atom that can't be destroyed. I am the motion and I am the void. What can I do? What can I do? I rise like a wing. The wind is my shepherd. The trees are my king. What can I do? What can I do?
They were walking down the leaving road, side by side, the minister and the monarch. To any distant eyes, it would have looked a charming scene. The colorfully hatted, white-haired grandfather, a thoughtful step behind his granddaughter. The almost mythical Trimus Picus Vermis roosting stonily on her shoulder. Even the speckling flowers of the Canderley field, dotting the green grass behind them, seemed especially vivid. As they strolled down the road, he could see the villagers spotting about in the square. "Keep them away from me," the monarch said coldly. She wore a sketched smile and clutched the rule book tightly to her chest. When enough of the ladies and fishermen had gathered, the whole herd of villagers began to mosey toward the roadhead, as though savoring the moment of Kittery's arrival. A few small instruments could be seen, a glinting trumpet, the silver strings of a jugged lute held in fidgeting, nervous hands. As the monarch and minister arrived at the edge of the square, the crowd separated into two smiling columns. A merry gauntlet, the arriving heroes were meant to process down. This reception would obviously include much fanfare, perhaps even hugging, and Kittery slowed to let the minister stand out before her. Minister Battlegrass raised his hands to settle the crowd, though he wasn't at all certain how he might satisfactorily disband them while maintaining their favor. "It is terribly fine to see you all on this day of our victory," he said loudly to cover up the quiver in his chest. A small cheer rose from the crowd, and the trumpeter shot out a single blast from his horn. "From her battle with the monarch," the minister continued, "you can see that my granddaughter is exceptionally exhausted and ill and injured and many other things besides. And, of course, she has only recently been freed from her engloming. And she is terribly sad as well because of the great losses. So there are many things weighing heavily on her all at once." The minister turned briefly around to see how he was doing. Kittery's expression darkened with impatience. As he turned back to face them, he was pleased to see that their ceremonial shape had collapsed somewhat. They were milling now, talking amongst themselves.
"What do you mean, losses?"
Mr. Nundine called out. He was at the far end of the line, but his voice carried easily.
"Mrs. Gramshaw, I'm afraid," the minister said. "Also, Muck and Archie were lost, though I'm pleased to say that Mrs. Brush has managed to survive."
The minister thought this an especially clever comment. To bring Mrs. Brush's into the upper echelon of survivors, as she would, no doubt, and however unfortunately, be playing no small role in the coming regime. He paused and gazed slowly around again at Kittery.
"Disperse them," Kittery hissed.
So, he continued uneasily,
"if you would be so kind as to return home now, ahead of us, please." "That's right. Kittery, I should say, would prefer no sort of thanks as yet.
We are heading to the counting house to set the rule book into the sacred ark for safekeeping, and then we would, she would, like to invite you all back to the White Palace, the freshly restored White Palace, I'm sure you'll be pleased to hear, for the feast of the coronation. The minister began to wave them all away and nodded as they turned their backs, one by one, and began to walk, ponderously, back into Olive. He returned to the monarch, who was busy paging through Kittery's rule book as she waited for the square to clear. "The fumbling little creature," she said finally, with a swollen thrill, after lingering on what must have been Kittery's most recent rule. "She's gotten free of the littoral. You must travel to Meadowlark, Minister." "Of course, Majesty," the minister said. "We can burn the book, take your bows from the steps, invite them all—"
"Before that, now," the monarch growled, "we'll need to keep the book a few days more until the job is done. For here is Kittery's rule number 98, she said, reading from the book now. "Test yourself without your friends. If you find nothing, look again. Without your eyes, discard the lens."
"I see," the minister said vaguely. "I must say I find such poetry inscrutable."
"She's in Tamerlane, being very naughty. If she hasn't already started, she will very soon enter the training ground of the Vens. That cannot be the historian's wish, which means only one thing. She has at least the gift of insight, and will therefore, even without her book, make the right action at the right time. She wants to learn more about her powers. Well, Minister, you will teach her instead about ours."
"Excellent," the minister said. "I agree completely. And in what manner do you foresee me unleashing this tutorial?" The monarch stepped toward him, and the minister stiffened.
"I shall give you a little gift, Minister," she said, and reached up with her small young hand and began to jab the nail of her thumb into his neck.
He took it quietly for a moment before recoiling suddenly back, but her dreadful empty eyes took hold of him once more. He put a hand on his hat and tipped his head that she might better force her thumb through the skin. A cold wind shot through his veins, and the minister listened downward to the faint pittering of blood as it dripped into the dirt. And the next thing he knew, in a kind of mindless daze, as though his brain had been put on ice, he was walking up Second Hill to the lodestone. He tried to stop and turn around for some further explanation from the monarch, but found that he was no longer moving exactly under his own power. He would travel to Meadowlark, to the stone in Tamerlane. After arriving at the wretched foggy school, he would install himself in certain places along the nine stations of the Vens. And when the time was right, and Kittery was close enough, he would reach out with his newly acquired murder fingers and touch her and anyone else that sought to protect her. No black fires would be kindled. He would make absolutely sure of that. As he stood on the lodestone and his mind brought up the destination image of Tamerlane, he noted that Mrs. Brushes had been right. New pleasures had arrived to replace the old. He might never again taste sweet air in his lungs, never again savor a fine meal, but his body ached with anticipation to end lives with the touch of his finger. That was the breath of absolute power. That was the food of a god. New pleasures indeed, he said to himself with a lustful shiver, before slipping down into the stone.
Down the path, through the woods, the falling snow.
my neighbor, black as ice, a silver dream, as we go skating down the stream. Available as an ebook for Kindle and other ebook reading devices for 99 cents. Search for Kittery Embers on Amazon.com or visit SherwinSleeves.com or RadioGhost.com for more information. The audio chapters will continue to be available for free, but if you like the story, please consider showing your support by purchasing and downloading the three books as they are made available. Thank you, my friends.